hear the grunts, the guys calling out picks, the staccato shuffling of sneakers. 10 guys are playing, 5-on-5. There are 3 guys on the sidelines waiting. A 4th approaches and asks, "You got next?" The guys nod. I recognize about half the players. Some I know from high school. Some are neighbors. The guy who runs the town lacrosse program is out there. Many of these guys work in the financial community, but I also spot 2 high school teachers. I don't see Hank. As the game comes to an end, they're playing to 10 by ones, a tall man I know parks and gets out of his car. One of the 4 waiting quickly points and calls out, "We got Myron!" The other guys start hooting and hollering at Myron. Myron smiles back sheepishly. "Look who's back," one guy calls out. The others join in. "How was the honeymoon, Romeo? You're not supposed to be tan, dude." "Yeah, you're supposed to stay indoors if you catch my drift," to which Myron says, "Yeah, I didn't get that at first, but once you added, if you catch my drift, it became clear to me." Lots of good-natured laughing and congrats to the groom. Remember Myron Bolitar, Leo? How Dad would take us to watch him play high school basketball in Livingston just to show us what greatness was? Myron used to be a confirmed old bachelor, or so I thought. He got married recently to a cable news anchor woman. I can still remember Dad's voice in the stands. "Seeing greatness," he would tell us, "is always worth it." That was Dad's philosophy. Myron ended up being great, a huge superstar at Duke University and a first-round NBA draft pick. Then, boom, he had a freak injury and never made it in the pros. There's a lesson there, too, I guess. But here on these courts, he's still treated like a hero. I don't know if that's due to nostalgia or what, but I get it. He's still something special to me, too. We are both adults now, but some part of me still feels a little intimidated and even uplifted when he shows me attention. I blend into the group greeting him. When Myron gets to me, I shake his hand and say, "Congrats on the nuptials." "Thanks, Nap. But you're a bastard for abandoning me. On the positive side, you're now the hottest bachelor in the area." Then, spotting something on my face, Myron pulls me aside. "What's up?" "I'm looking for Hank." "You do something wrong?" "No, I don't think. I just need to talk to him." "Hank usually plays Monday nights, right?" "Always," Myron tells me. "Of course, you never know what Hank you're going to get." "Meaning?" "Meaning Hank, fluctuates, behaviorally. Meds? Meds, chemical imbalance, whatever. But look, I'm not the guy to ask. I haven't been around here in over a month." "Extended honeymoon?" Myron shakes his head. "I wish." He doesn't want me to ask a follow-up, and I don't have time for it. "So who knows Hank the best?" Myron gestures at a handsome man with his chin. "David Rainiv." "For real?" Myron shrugs and heads onto the court. I can't imagine 2 lives on more opposite trajectories than Hank's and David Rainiv's. David was president of our high school class's National Honor Society and is now CEO of one of the country's biggest investment firms. You may have seen him on TV a few years ago when Congress was grilling big-shot bankers. David has a penthouse in Manhattan, but he and his high school sweetheart-cum-wife, Jill, raised their children here in Westbridge. We don't really have socialites in suburbia, more like keeping up with the Joneses, but whatever you label it, the Rainivs would be at the top of any heap. As the next game starts up, David and I find a bench on the other side of the court and sit. David is fit and looks like the love child of a Kennedy and a Ken doll. If you're casting the cleft-chinned senator, you could do worse than David Rainiv. "Well, I haven't seen Hank in 3 weeks," David tells me. "Is that unusual?" "He pretty much comes every Monday and Thursday." "And how is he?" I ask. "He's fine, I guess," David says. "I mean, he's never fine, if you know what I mean. Some of the guys..." He looks out at the court. "They don't really want Hank here. He acts out. He doesn't shower enough. On the sidelines, when he has to wait a game, he starts pacing and screaming various rants." "What kind of rants?" "Nonsensical stuff. He started shouting once about how Himmler hates tuna steaks." "Himmler? Like the old Nazi?" David shrugs. He keeps his eyes on the court, following the game. He rants, he paces, he scares some of the guys. But on the court, David smiles now, it's like he transforms into Hank again. For a little while, the old Hank comes back. He turns to me. You remember Hank in high school? I nod. Lovable, right? David says. Yes. I mean, a total nerd, but... You remember the time he pranked the teacher's Christmas party? It's something to do with their snacks, right? Right. So the teachers are all getting smashed. Hank sneaks in. He's mixed together bowls of M&Ms with bowls of Skittles. Oh, gross. So the teachers, they're wasted, right? And they reach and grab a fistful of candies and... He starts laughing. Hank filmed it. It was hilarious. I remember now. He didn't mean any harm. That was Hank. It was more a science experiment to him than a prank. David grows quiet for a moment. I follow his eyes. He's watching Myron take a jump shot. Swish. Hank isn't well, Nap. It isn't his fault. That's what I tell the guys who don't want him here. It's like he has cancer. You'd never tell a guy he can't play with us because he has cancer, right? Good point, I say. David is focused a little too much on the court. I owe Hank. How so? When we graduated, Hank went to MIT. You know that, right? Right, I say. I got accepted to Harvard a mile away. A thrill, right? We were close to each other. So freshman year, Hank and I still hung out. I'd come pick him up and we'd grab a burger somewhere or we'd go to parties, mostly on my campus, but sometimes his. Hank could make me laugh like no one else. There's a smile on his face now. He wasn't one for drinking, but he would stand in the corner and observe. He liked that. And girls liked him, too. There was a certain type drawn to him. The night has a hush to it now. The only sounds are the concentrated cacophony on the court. The smile slides off David's face like a veil. But things started to change, he says. The change was so slow I barely noticed it at first. Change how? Like, when I'd come to pick him up, Hank wouldn't be ready, or as we left, he'd check the door lock 2 or 3 times. It got worse. I'd come and he'd still be in a bathrobe. He would shower for hours. He would keep locking and unlocking the door, not 2 or 3 times, but 20 or 30. I'd try to reason with him. Hank, you already checked it. You can stop now. No one wants any of the crap in your room anyway. He started to worry his dorm would burn down. There was a stove in a public room. We'd have to stop by it and make sure it was off. It would take me an hour to get him outside. David stops. We watch the game for a few moments. I don't push him. He wants to tell it his own way. So one night, we're going out on a double date at this expensive steakhouse in Cambridge. He says to me, "Don't pick me up. I'll take the bus." I say, "Fine." I get the girls, we're there. I'm not telling this right. This girl, Kristen Megarji, I can see Hank is crazy about her, she's gorgeous, and a math geek. He was so excited. Anyway, you can probably guess what happened. He didn't show. Right. So I make up some excuse and take the girls home. Then I drive over to his dorm. Hank's still locking and unlocking the door. He won't stop. And he starts blaming me. Oh, you said that was next week. I wait. David lowers his head into his hands, takes a deep breath, lifts his head back up. I'm in college, David continues. I'm young, it's exciting, I'm making new friends, I got my studies, I got a life. And Hank, he isn't my job, right? Going over to fetch him is getting to be a real pain in the ass, so after that I start going less. You know how it is. He texts, I don't answer so fast. We drift apart. Suddenly it's a month, then a semester, then... I stay silent. I can feel the guilt coming off him. So these guys, he gestures to the court, think Hank is a weirdo. They don't want him here. He sits up. Well, too bad. Hank is going to play if he wants to play. He's going to play with us. And he's going to feel welcome. I give it a moment, and then I ask, "Do you have any idea where he might be?" "No. We still don't... We don't really talk except on the court. Hank and I mean. A lot of us go to McMurphy's after we play, you know, for a few pitchers and some pizza. I used to invite Hank, but when I did, he would actually run away. You've seen him walking around town, right? Yes, I say. Same mood every day, you know? Same time. Creature of habit. I guess that helps. Routine, I mean. We finish here at 9 o'clock, give or take, but if we go long, Hank still leaves at exactly 9. No goodbye, no explanation. He has an old Timex with an alarm. It dings at 9. He sprints away, even if it's the middle of a game. How about his family? Would he stay with them? His mom passed away last year. She lived in that old condo development in West Orange, Cross Creek Point. His dad might be there now. I thought his parents were divorced when we were little, I say. On the court, someone cries out and falls to the ground. He wants a foul, but the other guy is claiming that he's being a drama queen. They split up when we were in fifth grade, David says. His dad moved somewhere out west, Colorado, I think. Anyway, I think they might have reconciled when Mrs. Stroud got sick. I forget who told me that. The game in front of us ends when Myron hits a fadeaway jumper that kisses the backboard before dropping through the net. David rises. I got next, he reminds me. Did you ever hear of the Conspiracy Club, I ask him. No, what's that? Some guys in our class back in high school formed it. Hank was a member, so was my brother. Leo, he says with a sad shake of his head. He was a good guy, too. Such a loss. I don't reply to that. Did Hank ever talk about conspiracies? Yeah, I guess. Nothing specific, though. He never made much sense. Did you talk about the path, maybe? Or the woods? David stops and looks at me. The old military base, right? I say nothing. When we were in high school, Hank was obsessed with that place. He would talk about it all the time. What would he say? Nutty stuff, that the government was running LSD testing out of it or mind-reading experiments, stuff like that. You would sometimes wonder the same kinds of things, wouldn't you, Leo? But I wouldn't call you obsessed. You said it. You had fun with it. But I don't think you ever really bought into it. It seemed to me to be just a game to you, but maybe I misread your interest. Or maybe you were all in it for different reasons. Hank thought about big government plots, more alike the edge element, the mystery, the danger. You, Leo, I think you liked the camaraderie of the friends traipsing through the woods on an adventure, like something in an old Stephen King novel. Yo, David! We're ready to start, one guy yells. Myron says, give him a minute, we can wait. But they are all lined up and ready to play, and there is a protocol here. You don't make the group wait. David looks at me for permission. I nod that we are done, and he can go. He starts to step toward the game, but then he turns to me. Hank is still obsessed with that old base. Why do you say that? The walk Hank takes every morning? He starts by hiking up the path. Chapter 11. Reynolds calls me in the morning. I found the divorce attorney who hired Rex. Great. Not really. His name is Simon Fraser. He's a bigwig partner at Bigwig Elba Baroshan Fraser. You reach out to him? Oh, yes. I bet he was cooperative. I bet you're being sarcastic. Mr. Fraser won't speak with me due to attorney-client privilege and subsequent work product therein. I frown. Did he actually say therein? He did. We should be able to arrest him for that alone. If only we made the laws, Reynolds says. I was thinking of going back to his clients to see if they would waive privilege. You mean the wives he represented? Yes. A waste of time, I say. These women won custody cases based in part on Rex's DUI setup. They were not about to admit that. Their exes could use that illegality to reopen custody battles. Any ideas? Reynolds asks. Might as well pay Simon Fraser a visit in person. I think that, too, will be a waste of time. I can go alone, I say. No, I don't think that's a good idea. Then we go together. It's your jurisdiction, so you can approach him as a law enforcement officer, while you play the role of interested civilian. It's the role I was born to play. When? I have to make a couple of stops on the way, but I'll be up before lunch. Text me when you get close. I hang up, shower, get dressed, I check my watch. According to David Rainiv, Hank starts his walk up the path every morning at exactly 8:30. I park in the teacher's lot, which gives me an unobstructed view of the path. It's 8:15. I flip around the radio and land on Howard Stern for a while. It's 8:30 now. I keep my eyes on the path. No one approaches. Where is Hank? At 9, I give up and head to my second stop. The shelter Ellie runs caters mostly to battered families. I meet her at one of the transitional residences, an old Victorian located on a quiet street in Morristown. This is a place for the battered women and children to hide from their abusers until we can figure out the next step, which is usually something better, but not what anyone would consider desirable. There are very few big victories here. That's the tragedy. What Ellie does feels like emptying an ocean with a tablespoon. Still, she wades into the ocean tirelessly, time after time, day after day. And while she is no match for the evil in a man's heart, Ellie makes the battle worth it. Beth Lashley took her husband's name, Ellie tells me. She's now Dr. Beth Fletcher, a cardiologist in Ann Arbor. How'd you find that out? It was harder than it should have been. Meaning? I contacted all her closest friends from high school. None kept in touch with Beth, which surprised me. I mean, she was pretty social. I reached out to her parents again. I told them we wanted to get Beth's address for reunions and that kind of thing.
What did they say?
They wouldn't give it to me. They said to mail anything pertinent to them.
I don't know what to make of that, but it's not good.
So, how were you able to track her down? Through Ellen Major. Do you remember her?
She was a year behind us, I say.
But I think she was in my math class. That's Ellen. Anyway, she went to Rice University down in Houston.
Okay.
So did Beth Lashley. So I asked her to call the Rice alumni office and see if, as a fellow alum, she could get any information on her. That, I have to admit, is genius. Anyway, she got an email address with the Fletcher last name at the University of Michigan Medical Center. I did a little Googling to find out the rest. Here's her office number. Ellie hands me a slip of paper. I look at the slip of paper as though the phone number will give me a clue. Ellie leans back. How did it go with tracking down Hank? She asks.
Not well.
The plot thickens.
It does.
Oh, before you go, Marcia wanted to see you.
I'm on my way.
I kiss Ellie on the cheek. Before I head to Ellie's colleague Marcia Stein's office, I veer left and take the stairs to the second level. There's a makeshift daycare for the kids. I look inside and see Brenda's youngest working on a coloring book. I continue down the corridor. The door to her bedroom is open. I knock lightly and look inside the small room. Two open suitcases sit on the bed. When Brenda sees me, she rushes over and wraps her arms around me. She's never done that before. Brenda doesn't say anything. I don't say anything. When she lets go, she looks up and gives me a small nod. I give her a small nod back. We still don't say anything. When I head back into the corridor, Marcia Stein is waiting for me. Hey, Nap! When we were 8 and 9 years old, Marcia was our teenage babysitter. Do you remember Leo? She was lithe and gorgeous, a ballerina, a singer, the star of every high school play. We had crushes on her, of course, but so did everyone. Our favorite activity when she babysat was helping her rehearse for her plays. We would read her lines. During her junior year, Dad took us to the high school to see her play Hodel, the beautiful daughter in Fiddler on the Roof. Senior year, Marcia capped off her theater career playing the titular lead in Mame. You, my brother, got to play the part of Mame's nephew, listed in the program as Young Patrick. Dad and I went 4 times, and Marcia deservedly got a standing ovation at every performance. Back in those days, Marcia had a ruggedly handsome boyfriend named Dean, who drove that black Trans Am, and always, no matter how hot or cold the weather, wore his varsity wrestling jacket, the green one with the white sleeves. Marcia and Dean were the class couple in the Westbridge High School yearbook. They got married a year after graduation. Not long after that, Dean started to beat her. Savagely. Her eye socket is still caved in on the right. Her face looks disjointed now, off-kilter. The nose is too flat from the years of beating. After 10 years, Marcia finally found the courage to run away. As she often tells the abused women here, You find the courage too late, but it's never too late. And yes, that's a contradiction. She joined forces with another child she babysat in those days, Ellie, and together they formed these shelters. Ellie is CEO. Marcia prefers to stay behind the scenes. They now operate one shelter and four transition homes like this. They also have three locations with addresses that are completely unknown to the public for obvious reasons. They have a pretty good security system, but sometimes I chip in. I kiss Marcia's cheek. She isn't beautiful anymore. She isn't old, early 40s. When life gets beaten out of those who shine brightest, they recover, but sometimes that light never quite comes all the way back. She still likes acting, by the way. The Westbridge Community Players is putting on Fiddler in May. Marcia plays Grandma Zeitel. She pulls me to the side. Funny thing.
Oh?
I tell you about what a monster Trey is, and suddenly he ends up in the hospital. I say nothing. A few months ago, I told you about how Wanda's boyfriend sexually abused her 4-year-old daughter. Suddenly, he ends up...
I'm kind of in a rush, Marcia. I say to stop her. She looks at me. You can choose not to tell me your problems, I say. That's up to you.
I pray first.
Okay.
But praying doesn't work. That's when I go to you.
Maybe you're looking at it wrong, I say.
How's that? I shrug.
Maybe I'm just the answer to those prayers.
I cradle her face in both hands and kiss her cheek again. Then I hurry out before she can say more.
You probably wonder how I, as a cop sworn to uphold the law, justify what I did to Trey.
I don't. I'm a hypocrite.
We all are. I do believe in the rule of law, and I'm not a huge fan of vigilantism. But I don't look at what I sometimes do that way. I look at it like the world is a bar, and I see a man across the room beating the crap out of a woman, taunting her, laughing at her, cajoling her to give him one more try, like Lucy holding the football for Charlie Brown, and then, after offering her this hope, cruelly smashing her in the face again. I look at it like I just stopped by a friend's house and saw her boyfriend sexually assaulting her 4-year-old daughter.
Is your blood boiling? Should time and distance cool that?
So I pounce. I stop it. I have no illusions. I choose to break the law, and if I'm caught, I'll pay the penalty. I admit this isn't a great justification, but I don't really care. I start driving west toward the Pennsylvania border. There is, of course, a great chance Simon Fraser will not be in his office. If so, I will visit his house or wherever he may be. I may miss him. He may refuse to see me. This is how detecting works. You keep going, even if what you're doing seems like a momentous waste of time and energy.
I think about you as I drive. Here's my problem. For the first 18 years of my life, I have zero memories that aren't entangled in you. We shared a womb, then we shared a room. There was, in fact, nothing we did not share. I told you everything.
Everything. There is nothing I kept from you. There is nothing I was embarrassed or ashamed to tell you because I knew you'd still love me. For everyone else, there is a bit of a facade. There has to be. But with you and me, there was none. I held nothing, nothing back. But sometimes I wonder, did you? Were you keeping secrets from me, Leo?
An hour later, still driving, I call Dr. Beth Fletcher, née Lashley's office. I give my name to the receptionist and ask to speak to Dr. Fletcher. The receptionist tells me the doctor isn't in right now. In that weary, put-out voice only a doctor's receptionist can pull off, she asks what this is regarding. I'm an old friend from high school. I give her my name and mobile phone number. Then I add with as much urgency as I can muster, it's really important I talk to her. The receptionist is unfazed. I'll leave a message. I'm also a cop. Nothing. Please page Dr. Fletcher and tell her it's important. The receptionist hangs up without promising that she will. I place another call to Augie. He answers on the first ring and says, yeah. I know you want to stay out of this, I say. No reply. But could you tell your patrol guys to keep an eye out for Hank?
Won't be hard, Augie says. He takes the same walk every day.
Not this morning. I fill Augie in on my earlier failed stakeout by the path. I also tell him about my visit to the pickup basketball game last night. Augie is silent for a bit, and he says,
You know that Hank is not, well, right?
Right.
So what exactly do you think he's going to tell you?
Damned if I know, I say. More silence. I'm tempted to fill it with an apology for abruptly unearthing something he tried hard to keep buried. But I'm not really much in the mood to offer platitudes, and I doubt Augie would want to hear them.
I'll tell the guys to radio me if they see him.
Thanks, I say, but he's already hung up. The law offices of Elba, Baroche, and Fraser are located in a nondescript glass high-rise among a series of nondescript glass high-rises in a development I assume is being satirically labeled Country Club Campus. I park in a lot slightly larger than a European principality and find Reynolds waiting for me by the door. She's wearing a blazer over a green turtleneck.
Simon Fraser is here, she says.
How do you know?
I've been staking the place out since I called you. I saw him come in. I haven't seen him leave. His car is still here. From those observations, I deduced that Simon Fraser is here.
You're good, I say.
Don't be intimidated by my law enforcement prowess. The lobby is colorless and cold, like Mr. Freeze's lair. Several law firms and investment entities, and even one of those for-too-much-profit pseudo-colleges are housed in here. We take the elevator up to the sixth floor. The thin kid at reception sports two-day-old stubble, fashionable glasses, and a headset with a microphone. He lifts a finger to indicate we should give him a second. Then,
May I help you?
Reynolds takes out her badge.
We're here to see Simon Fraser.
Do you have an appointment?
For a moment, I think Reynolds is going to spit out, This badge is my appointment, which would, I confess, disappoint me. Instead, she says no. But that we would very much appreciate a moment of Mr. Fraser's time. The thin kid hits a button and whispers. Then he asks us to have a seat. We do. There are no magazines, just glossy law firm brochures. I page through one and find a photograph and bio for Simon Fraser. He is a Pennsylvania boy, through and through. He attended the local high school, then traveled to the western part of the state to get his BA at the University of Pittsburgh, before heading to the far eastern part of the state for his law degree at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. He is a nationally recognized family law practitioner. My eyes blur with boredom as I read about how he chaired this and that, authored this and that, served on this and that board, received this and that award for excellence in his chosen field. A tall woman in a gray pencil skirt saunters toward us.
This way, please.
We follow her down the corridor to a conference room with one glass wall and what I guess is supposed to be a breathtaking view of the parking lot and, if you look farther in the distance, a Wendy's and an Olive Garden. There's a long conference table with one of those speakerphones that looks like a gray tarantula in the center. Reynolds and I cool our heels for 15 minutes before the tall woman returns.
Lieutenant Reynolds?
Yes.
There's a call for you on line 3.
The tall woman leaves. Reynolds frowns at me. She puts a finger to her lips, indicating that I should keep quiet, and hits the speakerphone.
Reynolds,
she says.
A male voice replies. Stacy!
Yes?
What the hell are you doing at Simon Fraser's office, Stacy?
I'm working on a case, Captain.
What case might that be?
The murder of Officer Rex Canton.
Which our office is not handling because it's been passed on to county.
I had not known that.
And just following up a lead, Reynolds tells him. No, Stacy, you're not following up a lead. You're bothering a prominent citizen who is friends with at least two local judges. Both of the judges called to inform me that one of my lieutenants is harassing a practicing attorney who has already invoked attorney-client privilege.
Reynolds gives me the see what I'm dealing with eyes. I nod that I do.
Do I need to continue, Stacy?
No, Captain. I get the message. I'm out of here.
Oh, and they said you were with someone. Who would... Bye now.
Reynolds disconnects the call. As though cued, The tall woman opens the conference room door to escort us out. We rise and follow her to the end of the corridor. As we get in the elevator, Reynolds says, "Sorry to make you drive all the way up."
"Yeah," I say to her, "shame."
When we head outside, Reynolds says, "I better get back to the station, make it okay with my captain."
"Good idea."
We shake hands. She turns and starts to walk away.
"You gonna head straight back to Westbridge?" she asks me.
I shrug. "Might have lunch first. How's the Olive Garden?"
"How do you think?"
I don't go to the Olive Garden. There's an area of the parking lot for reserved parking. I find the sign that reads, "Reserved for Simon Fraser, Esquire," which is currently occupied by a shiny red Tesla. I frown, but try not to judge. The spot to his left, which is normally reserved for Benjamin Baroche, Esquire, is open. Good. I head back to my car. As I do, I pass a guy in his mid-40s smoking a cigarette. He's wearing a business suit and a wedding ring, and for some reason, the wedding ring matters to me. "Please don't smoke," I say to him. The guy gives me the same look, a hybrid of befuddled and annoyed, I always get when I do this.
"Huh?"
"You have people who care about you," I say. "I just don't want you to get sick or die."
"Mind your goddamn business," he snaps, tossing the butt to the ground like it offended him, and storming back inside. But part of me thinks, who knows? Maybe that'll be his last cigarette ever.
And they say I'm not an optimist. I check the entrance. No sign of Simon Fraser. I quickly get my car and pull it into the Baroche spot, hugging the right, so that mere inches separate my passenger side from his Tesla's driver's side. There's no way Simon Fraser could squeeze in and reach his door, forget opening it. I wait. I'm good with waiting. Waiting doesn't bother me. I don't really have to do true surveillance here. He's not going to be able to get into his car in a hurry. So I break out the novel I brought, ease my car seat all the way back, and start to read. It doesn't take long. At 12:15 p.m., I spot Simon Fraser exiting the building in my rearview mirror. I stick my bookmark between pages 312 and 313 and place the book on the passenger seat. I wait. Simon is talking animatedly on the phone. He draws closer to the car. With his free hand, he fishes into his pocket and grabs his key fob. I hear the little beep-beep noise of the door unlocking. I wait some more. When he stops short, I know he's realized the parking situation. I hear his muffled, "What the hell?" I lift my phone and put it to my ear and pretend I'm talking to someone. With my other hand, I take hold of the door handle. "Hey! Hey, you!" I ignore Simon Fraser and keep the phone to my ear. This angers him. He comes around my side of the car and, using what I assume is his college ring, he raps on the driver's side window.
"Hey! You can't park here!"
I turn toward him and gesture with the phone to indicate I'm kinda busy. His face reddens. Simon Fraser knocks harder with the school ring. I re-grip the door handle.
"Listen, asshole!"
I open my car door fast, smacking him in the face. Simon Fraser falls back. His phone flies from his hand and crashes against the pavement. I don't know if it's broken or not. I get out of the car before he has time to recover and say, "I've been waiting for you, Simon." Simon Fraser gently puts his hand to his face as if checking for no blood, I say. "Yet."
"Is that a threat?"
"Yeah, could be." I put my hand out to help him up. "Here, let me help you out." He stares at my hand as if I'm holding a turd in it. I smile at him. I give him the crazy, "I don't give any F's" eyes. He scuttles back a bit.
"I'm here to save your career, Simon."
"Who are you?"
"Nap Dumas."
My intent with this whole play is not to hurt him so much as bewilder and disorient. This is a man who is used to being in control, to neat lines and rules, to making his problems go away with phone calls to well-placed sources. He is not accustomed to off-the-beaten-path conflict or lack of control, and if I play it right, I can take advantage of that.
I'm calling the police."
"No need," I say, spreading my arms. "I'm a cop."
"What can I do for you?" "You're a police officer?"
"I am."
His face turns a tad redder. "I'll have your badge." For illegal parking?
For assault!
The car door? That was an accident, sorry. But sure, let's call more cops to the scene. You can see about having my badge for opening a car door, and I point to myself with my thumb, can see about having you disbarred. Simon Fraser is still on the ground. I hover over him, not really giving him room to rise without my help. It's not an uncommon power play. I reach out my hand again. If he tries anything, a possibility at this stage, I'm ready. He takes my hand and I pull him up. Simon Fraser brushes himself off.
I'm leaving, he announces.
He walks over, picks up his phone, brushes that off too, like it's a small dog. I can see the cracked screen from here. Now that there is some distance, he glares at me.
You'll pay for any damage.
I smile back at him.
Nah.
He glances at his car, but mine still blocks the driver's door. I can tell he's now calculating the pros and cons of crawling across the passenger seat and driving away.
You tell me what I need to know, I say. We keep this all between us. And if I don't tell you?
I shrug.
I destroy your career.
He snickers. You think you can?
Not sure, to be honest, but I won't rest until I do.
I have nothing to lose, Simon. I don't care if you, I make quote marks with my fingers,
have my badge. I'm single, I have no social standing, in sum, to repeat, I have nothing to lose. I take a step closer.
But you, on the other hand, well, you have a family, a reputation, what the papers like to call, again with the finger quotes, standing in the community.
You can't threaten me. I just did.
Oh, and if somehow I can't destroy your reputation, one day I'll come by and kick your ass. Plain and simple. Old school. He looks at me in horror. My brother is dead, Simon. You may be standing in the way of me finding out who killed him. I take another step toward him. Do I look like the kind of guy who'll just let that slide?
He clears his throat.
If this has something to do with the work Officer Rex Canton did for our law firm, as a matter of fact it does, then I can't help you. As I've already explained, the work falls under attorney-client privilege. Not when that work you hired him to do is a crime, Simon.
Silence. Ever heard of entrapment?
Another throat clear, less sure this time.
What on earth are you talking about?
You hired Officer Rex Canton to get dirt on ex-husbands, so as to benefit your clients.
Simon snaps into lawyer mode.
One, I wouldn't characterize Officer Canton's work in that way. Two, having someone do background checks on the opposition is neither illegal nor unethical.
He wasn't doing background checks, Simon.
You have no proof.
Sure I do. Pete Corwick, Randy O'Toole, and Nick Weiss. Did those names ring a bell?
Silence.
Cat got your tongue, counselor?
More silence. By startling coincidence, Officer Rex Canton happened to arrest all three of these men for drunk driving. By startling coincidence, your firm represented all three of those men's wives in custody battles at the time of those arrests.
I grin. He tries.
That isn't proof of a crime.
Think the media will see it that way, too?
If you breathe a word of these unfounded accusations to the press, you'll have my badge. I get it. Look, I'm going to ask you two questions. If you answer them honestly, that's it. Your short nightmare known as me is over. If you don't answer them, however, I go to the papers and the American Bar Association, and I tweet out what I know on Facebook or whatever the kids call it nowadays.
Fair enough.
Simon Fraser wouldn't say it, but I could see from the slump in his shoulders that I had him. So here's the first question. What do you know about the woman who worked with Rex on the DUI stings?
Nothing.
The answer came fast. You know he used a woman to seduce the guys into excess drinking, right?
Men flirting with women in bars.
Simon Fraser shrugs, trying to recover a bit of his normal bluster now.
The law doesn't care why they drink, just how much.
So who is she?
No idea, he says,
and his words have the ring of truth. Do you really think anyone in my firm, especially me, would want to know details like that?
No, it was a long shot, but worth taking.
Second question. Final question, he counters.
Who hired your firm to set up the DUI the night Rex Canton was murdered?
Simon Fraser hesitates.
He is thinking it over.
I let him.
The red is gone from his face now, replaced with something more in the Ash family.
Are you implying that Officer Canton's, work for our firm led to his murder?
More than implying. You have evidence of that?
An assassin flew in for just that purpose. He rented a car and headed to that bar. He pretended to get drunk with Rex's female associate. He waited until Officer Canton pulled him over. Then he shot and killed him.
He seems taken aback by this.
It was a setup, Simon. Pure and simple.
It shouldn't have come to this. Me hanging out in a parking lot making threats.
I think Simon Fraser knows that now. He is more dazed now than when the car door knocked him on his ass.
I'll get you the name.
Good. I can check the billing after lunch, he says, checking his watch. I'm late to see a client. Simon, he looks at me.
Skip the lunch. Get the name now.
I'm blocking on Mora. I'm doing it for several reasons. The most obvious, of course, is so that I can concentrate on the case at hand. Emotion will not help. I'm obviously more driven on this case because of my personal connections here, you, Mora. But I can't let it cloud my brain or allow wants to twist my thinking. In short, I can't help but hope. There is a chance, slight as it might be, that there is a reasonable answer to all this, and that when Mora and I see each other again, when I think of that moment, my mind goes to places it shouldn't. It goes to a future, and long walks holding hands, and longer nights under the sheets. And then it goes to children, and repainting the back deck, and coaching Westbridge Little League, and yes, of course, I know how silly this all sounds, and I would never voice this to anyone, and perhaps again, you are witnessing what I miss without you in my life. It's crazy enough I talked to my dead brother, right? We sit in Simon Fraser's office. The tall woman hands Simon a file. He opens it, and something comes across his face.
What? I say.
I haven't hired Rex Canton in a month. Simon Fraser looks up at me, the relief washing over him. I don't know who hired him that night, but it wasn't me.
Maybe someone else in your firm?
Simon hems a bit here. I would doubt it. Rex worked exclusively for you.
I don't know about that.
But at this firm, well, I'm a senior partner and the only one who works family law, so... He doesn't finish the thought, but I get it. Rex was his boy here. None of the other lawyers would dare hire him without Simon Fraser's prior consent. My mobile rings. The caller ID reads Westbridge PD. I excuse myself and step aside.
Hello?
It's Augie's voice on the other end.
I think I know why we can't find Hank.
Chapter 12. When I arrive at Westbridge's police station the next morning, Augie is waiting there with a rookie cop named Jill Stevens. I started as a Westbridge patrolman, and still work as a sort of hybrid investigator for both the county and this town. Augie brought me in and then pushed me up the ladder. I like this rung. I'm a big county investigator with a hint of small-town cop. I have zero interest in money or glory. That's not faux modesty. I'm happy being right where I am. I solve the cases and pass on the credit. I want no further advancement or demotion. I am left alone for the most part, and free of the political quicksand that sucks down so many. I'm in my sweet spot. The Westbridge Police Station is an old bank in the middle of old Westbridge Road. 8 years ago, the new high-tech station opened on North Elm Street and flooded during a storm. With nowhere else to go during repairs, they rented space from the seen-better-days Westbridge Savings Bank a Greco-Roman-inspired savings and loan built in 1924. It still had the bones, the marble floors and high ceilings and dark oak counters. They turned the old-school vault into a holding cell. The town council still claims that the police will move back into the North Elm Street station, but 8 years later, they haven't begun construction. We all sit in Augie's second-floor office, which used to be the bank manager's. There's nothing on the walls behind him, no artwork, no flags, no awards or degrees or citations like you see in every other police captain's office. There are no photos on his desk. To an outsider, it's like Augie's half-packed for retirement already. But this is my mentor. Awards and citations would be boasting. Artwork would be sharing himself in ways he'd rather not. Photos, well, even when Augie had family, he didn't want to take them to work. Augie's behind his desk. Jill sits to my right, holding a laptop and a file. Augie says, 3 weeks ago, Hank came in with a complaint. Jill here took his statement. We both look at Jill. She clears her throat and opens the file. The complainant presented himself as very agitated when he entered. Augie says, Jill. She looks up. You can skip the formal talk. We're all friends here. She nods and closes the file. I've seen Hank around town. We all know his reputation, but I just checked the records. Hank has never come to this station before. Well, let me correct that. I mean, he's never voluntarily come in. We've picked him up when he acts out, just held him for a few hours until he calms down. Not in a holding cell, just a chair downstairs. What I mean is, he's never come in to file a complaint. I try to move this along. You said he was agitated? I've witnessed his rantings before, so at first I was just sort of humoring him. I figured he needed to vent and that he would calm down. But he didn't. He said people were threatening him, yelling things at him.
What kind of things?
He wasn't clear. But he seemed genuinely scared. He said people were lying about him. Every once in a while, he'd take on a weird, studious tone and start talking about defamation and slander like he was his own lawyer or something. The whole thing was bizarre. Until he showed us the video. Jill scooches her chair closer to me and opens the laptop. It took a while for Hank to make sense, but eventually he showed me this. She hands me the laptop. There's a still for a video on Facebook. I can't make out what it is yet. A forest, maybe? Green leaves from trees? My eyes travel up. The heading of the video shows the name of the page where it had been posted. Shame a perv, I say out loud.
The Internet, Augie says, as if that explains everything.
He leans back and folds his hands on his paunch. Jill clicks the play button. The video starts off shaky. The moving images are narrow with blurry sides, meaning it was shot on a smartphone held vertically. In the distance, I can make out a man standing alone behind the backstop of a baseball diamond. That's Sloan Park, Jill says.
I already recognized it. It's the field adjacent to Benjamin Franklin Middle School.
The video jerkily zooms in on the man. No surprise, it's Hank. He looks like what you used to call a hobo. He is unshaven. His jeans are loose and faded to the point of near white. He wears a flannel shirt unbuttoned to reveal a once-white, moth-ravaged, one hopes, undershirt. For a second or two, nothing happens. The camera seems to settle its jitters and come into focus. Then a woman, probably the one doing the filming, whispers, "This dirty pervert exposed himself to my daughter." I glance at Augie, who remains stoic. Then I turn my attention back to the screen. Judging by the up-and-down motion and the way the video is closing in on Hank, I assume the woman doing the filming is walking toward him. "Why are you here?" the woman shouts. "What do you think you're doing?" Hank Stroud sees her now. His eyes go wide. "Why are you exposing yourself to children?" Hank's eyes dart about like scared birds trying to find a place to land. "Why do our police allow perverts like you to endanger our community?" For a second, Hank puts his hands up to his eyes, as though blocking a bright light that doesn't exist. "Answer me!" Hank bolts away. The camera pans to follow him. Hank's pants start to slip. He holds them up with one hand and continues to run toward the woods.
If you know anything about this pervert, the woman making the video says, please post it. We need to keep our children safe.
The video ends on that note. I look up at Augie.
Did anyone complain about Hank?
People always complain about Hank.
That he exposed himself?
Augie shakes his head.
Just that they don't like the looks of him walking around town, disheveled. He smells. He talks to himself. You know the deal.
I do. But never anything about exposing himself.
Never.
Augie gestures toward the laptop with his chin.
Take a look at the view count at the bottom of the video.
My jaw drops. 3,789,452 views.
Whoa.
It went viral, Jill says. Hank came in here the day after it was uploaded. There were already 500,000 hits.
What did he want you to do? I ask her.
Jill opens her mouth, thinks about it, closes it.
He just said he was scared.
He wanted you to protect him?
Yeah, I guess.
And what did you do? Augie says,
nap.
Jill shifts in her seat.
What could I do?
He was so vague about everything, I told him to come back if there was a specific threat.
Did you look into who posted the video?
No. Jill looks wide-eyed at Augie. I put the file on your desk, Captain. Should I have done more?
No, you did fine, Jill. I can take it from here. Leave the laptop. Thanks.
Jill looks at me as if I'm supposed to say something to absolve her. I don't blame her for the way she handled it, but I'm not in the mood to let her off the hook, either. I stay quiet as she leaves. When we are alone, Augie frowns at me.
She's a rookie, for crying out loud.
Someone on that video is accusing Hank of a pretty serious offense.
Put it on me, then, Augie says.
I make a face and wave him off.
I'm the captain. My subordinate left the file on my desk. I should have gone through it better. You want to blame somebody, blame me.
Right or wrong, this isn't where I want to go with this. I'm not blaming anybody. I hit the play button and watch the video again. Then I watch it a third time. His pants are loose, I say to him.
You think maybe they slipped?
I don't. Neither does he.
Check out the comments underneath, Augie says.
I move the cursor down. There are over 50,000 of them.
Just click top comments and read a few.
I do as he asks. And as always, when reading a comments section, my faith in humanity plummets. Someone should castrate this guy with a rusty nail. I want to chain that perv to the back of my truck and drag his ass. This is what's wrong with America. Why is this pedo-ophile roaming free? His name is Hank Stroud. I saw him peeing in the parking lot at the West Bridge Starbucks. Why waste my tax dollars by putting that deviant in a prison? Take this Hank out back like you would a rabid dog. Hope that freak walks through my yard, got a new rifle I'm dying to try out. Someone should pull down his pants, bend him over, and... You get the idea. Too many posts begin with someone should, and then offer up a skew of torture possibilities so creatively sick that Torquemada would have been envious.
Nice, huh? Augie says.
We need to find him.
I put out a bulletin statewide.
Maybe we should try his dad.
Tom?
Augie looks surprised.
Tom Stroud moved away a long time ago.
Rumor has it he came back, I say.
For real?
Someone told me he's living in his ex's place in Cross Creek Point.
Huh, Augie says.
Huh, what?
We were pretty tight in a day, Tom and I. After the divorce, he moved out to Wyoming, Cheyenne. A couple of us went out there, has to be 20 years ago, and took a fly fishing trip with him.
When was the last time you saw him?
That trip. You know how it is. A guy moves across the country, you lose touch.
Still, I say, you just said you two were pretty tight. I look at him.
Augie gets where I'm going with this.
He looks down at the main floor of the station. It isn't busy. It rarely is.
Fine, he says with a sigh, heading for the door. You drive.
Chapter 13. We drive in silence for a few minutes. I want to say something to Augie. I want to apologize for unearthing what he'd worked so hard to bury. I want to tell him that I'm going to turn around, that I'm going to drop him back off at the station, that I can handle this entirely on my own. I want to tell him to call Yvonne, and maybe give it one more try, and forget I said anything about his dead daughter. But I don't. Instead, I say, my theory isn't adding up anymore. How's that? My theory, if you want to call it that, was that this all has to do with what happened to Leo and Diana. Out of the corner of my eye, I can see Augie deflate. I push on. I figured that it has something to do with that conspiracy club, 6 possible members that we know of. Leo and Diana.
We don't know Diana was a member.
There's a snap in his voice, which I completely get.
She wasn't wearing one of those silly pins in the yearbook.
Right, I say slowly, carefully. That's why I said possible members.
Fine, whatever.
If you don't want me to talk about this,
do me a favor, Nap. Just tell me what's now wrong with your theory, okay?
I nod. As the two of us get older, we get more equal. But Augie is still the mentor, I the mentee. 6 possible members, I say again. Diana and Leo
are dead, he says. So is Rex. That leaves Maura, who is at the scene of Rex's murder, that cardiologist out west.
Beth Fletcher, nay Lashley.
And Hank, Augie says.
And he's the problem, I say.
How so?
3 weeks ago, before Rex was murdered, someone posted that viral video of Hank. Then Hank goes missing. Then Rex gets killed. I don't see how there can be a connection. Whoever posted the video, that was a random thing by a school parent. That can't be connected to the old base or the conspiracy club, right?
Seems unlikely.
He rubs his chin with his right hand.
May I make an observation?
Shoot.
You want this too much, Nap. And you don't want it enough,
I fire back, which is a dumb thing for me to say. I expect and deserve fireworks. Instead, Augie chuckles.
Anyone else? I'd punch them in the mouth for that.
That was out of line, I say. I'm sorry.
I get it, Nat. Even if you don't.
What are you talking about?
You aren't just in this because of Leo and Diana, he says. You're in it for Maura.
I just sit and let the words sting.
If Maura hadn't run off, you'd been able to put Leo's death behind you. You'd have questions, of course, like I do. But that's the difference here. Whatever answer we come up with, even if it changes what we know about Leo and Diana, it doesn't really change anything for me. My daughter's dead body will still be rotting in that cemetery. But for you...
There is a deep sadness in Augie's voice, and I think it may be pity for me.
For you, there's Maura.
We pull up to the gate in front of the condo development. I shake it off.
Focus. Concentrate.
It is easy to poke fun at these sorts of real estate developments, the placid sameness, the lack of any sense of individuality, the snap-together structuring, the overly orchestrated landscapes. But I've thought about moving into one ever since I reached adulthood. The idea of paying one monthly maintenance fee and doing no exterior work appeals to me. I hate to mow the lawn. I don't like to garden or barbecue or do any of the classic homeownership rites of passage. I wouldn't care in the slightest if the exterior of my home looked exactly the same as my neighbor's. I don't even feel any special connection to the physical structure where we were raised. You, Leo, would stay with me wherever I would go. So why don't I move? I'm sure a psychiatrist would have a field day with that one, but I don't think the answer is that deep. Maybe it's easier to stay. Moving is an effort. Classic science. A body at rest stays at rest. I don't buy that explanation, but it's the best I've got. The condo guard is armed with nary a nightstick. I flash my badge at him and say, "We're here to see Tom Stroud." He studies the badge, hands it back to me.
"Is Mr. Stroud expecting you?"
"No."
"Do you mind if I call and let him know you're here? I mean, it's kind of policy."
I look at Augie. Augie nods. I say, "No problem." The guard places the call. He hangs up, gives us directions to make the second left past the tennis courts, and sticks a parking pass on the windshield. I thank him and drive. Tom Stroud is standing by an open door as we pull